This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Residents in northern Newton County have a new agricultural neighbor coming in the form of an organic dairy, which is entitled the family calls it the official title of the dairy is Natural Prairie Dairy, if I get it right. And we have one of the family members with us here in the studio to talk about it and the links that they have to dairy farming and farming in general and how it's moved up from of all places, Texas, into northern Indiana. Will DeYoung is the nephew of Donald and Sherry DeYoung, and they are the ones who are the operators of Natural Prairie Dairy, which is located now in northern Newton County, not terribly far from the Kankakee River, I understand. And they've gotten into the news because of the operations of the dairy and what they are planning to do here. Will, thank you for joining us here in the studio today on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you for having me.
If you will, the name DeYoung is a good Dutch name and is not unknown for folks here in northern Indiana and dairy farmers or farmers in general to be Dutch. We know that the entire town of Highland was founded by Dutch farmers, which is something that Will didn't even know. We talked about that here as we began our conversation. Tell us about the DeYoung family in particular, how they've gotten involved in dairy farming in particular in the Plain States and now the move to northern Indiana.
Sure. No, and like you said, dairy farming is very much a little bit of a Dutch tradition. Mm-hmm. And well, to be honest, I'm a fourth generation dairy farmer. My grandparents immigrated from the Netherlands in the 1950s with not much in their name, and they saved up enough money to buy a dairy farm in the 1980s in California with about 100 cows on it. And over time, we've been able to grow and eventually moved into to Texas and call that's where we call our home for Natural Prairie. And now we are looking at a great opportunity to expand into Indiana.
Now, how did because your family members, the DeYoungs, come up from Texas to northern Indiana. Did you just talk to family members, other members of the family, perhaps extended family, about the opportunities to come into Newton County? What made this area near the Kankakee River in northern Newton County attractive for an organic dairy farm, to be sure?
Sure. You know, there's a lot of great things about Indiana that kind of brought us here. You know, one of the first things was simply an opportunity for us to expand our business and be closer to, I guess, the Midwest as well as the East Coast. In addition to that, Newton County really is a strong farming area with great farmers. The farm itself has a long production history. And one of the things that actually got us really excited about coming up here is the sandy soil. That's great for drainage, and that's great for grazing cows out on pasture.
Tell us about the area that you have all moved into and where you're establishing the farm now.
Sure. It's on the northern part of Newton County. I believe we're about 5 to 6 miles south of the town of Lake Village, and it is a land base of about 2,500 acres, and we've been farming it organically for almost 3 years now. It is a three-year process to convert land that was farmed conventionally and to turn it into organic farmland. Mm-hmm. So over the past 3 years, we've been already farming it organically, and when I talk about organic, I'm talking about no pesticides, no fungicides, no herbicides, and then in terms of the inputs, we're really talking about no genetically modified seeds or inputs for that matter.
Now, what do you grow on the farm right now?
So right now we have it established mainly in pasture grasses, alfalfa mm-hmm. and pasture grasses, and that's a big component of what we plan on doing there is grazing naturally outside with our cattle.
I was going to ask you if that's where the dairy cows come in. You have to look for some grazing land, of course, and that's what you say you're going into. So this way you have certified organic milk that will come from the cows. Tell us about the stock, the livestock coming in.
Sure. Right now they're all based in Texas. And when the facility is up and running and we are certified organic, we'll have the cattle up here in Indiana. And, you know, I guess the main purpose of what we're trying to establish right now is really getting that ground ready and getting our pastures ready, because one of the requirements of organic farming is that they have to be out on pasture for 120 days of the year mm-hmm. and making sure that we have a good feed base for them and a good pasture setup.
Now, when you have cows coming in and they're going to be spending so much time as you say they will, in grazing on the land here. Coming up here to northern Indiana, you're getting familiar with how the winters are. We are luckily now we're going into the nice winter, nice weather months. Going through spring and summer, of course, and fall will be fine. But come winter, they're going to be needing to spend some time, I'm sure, indoors. Or they're going to be spending some grazing time, I'm sure, out. But they're going to have to spend some time indoors. What do you have to do to get an organic farm like this ready for the months where they can't be outside?
Sure, no, and that's certainly something we've had to look into in terms of setting up the facility for these colder weather months. Mm-hmm. But again, it comes down to we're only going to be putting our cows out on pasture when the weather is right for it. And we certainly won't be putting cows out to pasture in non-growing conditions or wet or soggy conditions. It really needs to be the ideal conditions. So it's all about doing what's best for the land and doing what's best for our animals.
The website talks about something which is called traceability, and what does that mean for an organic farm like the natural prairie dairy farm?
Sure. What it comes down to is we like to call it from grass to glass. Mm-hmm. Pretty much taking, and this is part of our organic certification and requirements, is we need to keep records and really trace out every single input that we're putting on the farm, every single pass that we're doing on the farm, making sure that we have a strong record of where exactly our cows are going, how they're being fed, and that's all part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you're going to have cows on the farm and an organic dairy farm, as you're working on now, besides having the pasture for them to graze on, they have to have water. What do you do for as far as providing well water and other sources of water for the animals?
Sure. No, we have well water set up on the facility for the animals. Mm-hmm. And then also when they're grazing, we do have water available for them then. And the great thing about our site is that, there are irrigation wells set up there. At the same time, I will note that, in order to set up our facility, we've actually had to take out a few of the irrigation pivots and wells. And at the end of the day, we've kind of done the math here, and we're not really going to be using any more water on this site than what's historically been used.
Mm-hmm. When you take land like this that's been basically agricultural, you're turning it into pasture land in turn to be able to raise cows and to provide the milk, the organic products that you're going to be putting out from the dairy. What kind of work that you have to do just to make the change over from what the land had been before into pasture land? Is there any real – is it just letting it kind of go fallow? Are you making some official changes that you have to make?
So really the process involves just being or farming organically. Even though you can't sell these crops for conventional, you still have to do it in organic matter.
Right.
And as of July, we will then be certified organic. But again, it comes down to growing these crops – no herbicides, no pesticides, no GMO seeds or anything like that. Doing that all properly and showing that you've done that for 3 years. And then at that point in time, then you can be called certified organic.
Now, once you get things certified and the pasture land is ready for the cows to come in, and you bring the livestock in, as you say, from the Plain States coming into northern Indiana, how long does it take to get them to graze and produce milk and in turn get the product out to the markets? And what type of markets are going to be interested in taking on organic milk?
Sure. I guess really where we're providing our milk is mainly to private label grocers. Mm-hmm. As fluid milk. And when we bring these cows in, most of these are going to be milking animals, and we need to make sure that when you bring them in, that first thing you got to do is you got to take care of them. You got to give them water, you got to feed them, and you got to milk them.
Now, are there any markets that are set up or are being set up here to be able to handle the product that's going to come out from the Natural Prairie Dairy?
We are engaged with a few local grocers.
That's great. So there will be product that folks here in Northwest Indiana will be able to buy in the organic dairy section of the stores. You say you're working on the markets right now. How difficult is it to find a market for organic milk here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, organic milk is a market just like any other market where it's subject to supply and demand conditions. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that, I guess, the market go up and down a little bit lately. But I think overall there's still a strong market for organic milk.
Yeah. We've talked here about the product that's going to come out from the dairy once the cows are on the land and grazing and eating and creating milk. What kind of a work have you had to do up to this point now in trying to be a good neighbor to Northwest Indiana, since it's been basically just agricultural land up to this point? Now you're talking about creating a dairy farm.
Yes. And you know, one of those part of, I guess, establishing a dairy farm here is you don't just come in and build one of these and set these up and then leave town 5-10 years later. Mm-hmm. We want to be in Newton County for a very long time, and part of that is being a good neighbor. And we know that if we're going to be a good neighbor, we got to be good environmental stewards as well. So you can't have one without the other. So that is certainly something that we've been spending a lot of time making sure that we're doing not only what's, I guess, required of us through rules and regulations, but also taking the time to see where can we go above and beyond what's required.
Yeah. We know in recent weeks here, there have been some community meetings. In fact, there was one community meeting here on Friday, April 20th to talk more about the farm. When you have these meetings set up here, what do you tell the folks here in northern Newton County and southern Lake County, which will be parts of, the neighbors that you will have here as around your dairy farm? What have you talked with them about here? What information have you passed on to them?
Sure, and we were able to attend this meeting last Friday in Lake Village, and I think it was a great opportunity. We said we were there to simply listen, learn, and address where we can. Mm-hmm. And I think it all goes back to our message of traceability and sustainability. We want to be here for a long time in Newton County, and again, it comes down to being environmentally conscious of what you're doing and taking the time to explain to people. Sometimes there's things that are misunderstood, and sometimes there's things that we didn't quite hear them on either. So just taking the time to fully understand what people's concerns are and addressing them as much as we can.
When you set up such a large dairy farm is what you're planning for here on this property in Newton County, and then you're dealing with not only taking care of the cows, feeding them, getting the water to them so that they're grazing and they're producing the milk and all, and then you've got the waste products, of course, that come out of a large farm like this. What have you had to set up, or are you setting up in this particular case to deal with that? Because that's I guess part of the end product. That's the other end, so to speak, here, where the milk is coming going to market here. And you're taking care of the cows and all. What special things do you have to do in particular because this is going to be an organic dairy?
Sure, and I guess I would frame that by saying, you know, we always have one kind of key mantra when we're doing things, and that's the real message is if you take care of the land and you take care of the cows and you take care of your people, they will take care of you. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I want to frame this around is because ultimately, yes, there is that end product. And what we're doing with that end product is we're going to be collecting it every single day and processing it every single day. And when you put it back out on the land, when you apply it, we apply it at what's called the agronomic rate.
Right.
And really what that is applying it for exactly what the crop's intakes needs are. So the growing crop has a specific need for, say, nitrogen or phosphorus, and you apply it for exactly what that crop needs. So one of the things we're doing is we're investing in a technology that allows us to have better control of these nutrients that come out of the manure.
Is this going to be a different setup than, say, what would be considered the average confined animal feeding lot or lot of some sort? I guess most people think of CAFOs, I think, in terms of pigs primarily here. And we're talking about cows. Is there any difference between the animals? And because we're talking about this different size of an operation compared to a huge pork-producing operation?
Sure, and I'd say one of the biggest things is one that we're organic, and you know these animals have to graze mm-hmm. for 120 days of the year. So that is a big part of it.
I guess in closing, Will, when you talk about trying to be an operation that's going in turn to provide organic dairy products for not only for the markets here in Northwest Indiana, but hopefully beyond, and you talk about being good stewards of the environment as well as being good neighbors, it's a challenge, I would imagine, but is this one that you think is surmountable that you're able to be able to do that you'll be able to be everything to everybody in this respect?
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, us coming up here into Indiana is a huge opportunity, but also a huge investment. And we're not going to do this unless we know that we can do it right. And that's why we're here, is because we believe what we're doing is right and that we can do it successfully and making sure that we're environmentally conscious of everything that we do, too.
Now, you've given us a little timetable here about getting the land ready for grazing. to bring the cows in so that they'll be able to enjoy themselves, get acclimated. Because when you're moving livestock around, moving for certainly from a great distance, like in this case, you're moving them up from the Plain States up here to Indiana. How long does it take, I guess, for them to get used to the land, feel comfortably grazing out there? And I'm sure it won't take very long. They'll find something tasty to eat, and they'll start getting acclimated to being here in northern Indiana, and in turn producing milk. How soon would you hope to have the product in? You're working on the markets right now, but are we looking at yet this summer or this fall?
You know, I think at this point in time, we're probably looking a little bit into 2019 as we take some more time to, mm-hmm. I guess, slow down and address all of the concerns and listen, understand what's going on around us. But like I said, one of the main things that we're excited about, I guess two of the things, is one is the pasture up here. This is a very different environment than Texas, and we're excited about the potential for what kind of pasture quality we can have up here. And secondly, you know, being able to take the time to evaluate some of this new technology we're looking at for manure processing.
We're talking with Will DeYoung, who is the nephew of the owners of this farm, Donald and Sherry DeYoung. They're, of course, creating a certified organic dairy farm, as well as creating the dairy operation itself in northern Newton County. The farm itself is called Natural Prairie Dairy, and we're looking forward to the product that will come out from the cows that will be moving up here from other places in northern Indiana. And, Will, thank you very much for spending some time with us to explain what the operation's like and to welcome to Northwest Indiana and hopefully be a prosperous as well as not only a good neighbor to the folks in the region, but also a good product as well, too, that we get to see in the stores very soon. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
Yep, thank you for having me, Chris. And if anyone else has questions on it, I encourage anyone to visit our website, organicfarm.land.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Our next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
In my neighborhood in Glen Park, nobody had any money. There really were no professionals. This wasn't doctor, lawyer, that kind of a neighborhood. These guys were steel workers and et cetera. A typical day for me was a lot of chaos. This is a two-bedroom house, one bathroom. So you could picture five kids and two adults. You can imagine we didn't live very well. It was loud. It was dirty. It was messy. You know, I had just about the greatest friend that a guy could have. This guy knew how I lived. He could never come over to my house. It was just, I would be too embarrassed to have anybody in my house. As much as I could get away from my house, I did. Didn't mean I didn't love my brothers and sisters and my parents. Just couldn't stand the dirt and the noise. You know, growing up, race was never discussed around me. Nobody in the block would ever talk about this. That's what's so strange about Gary. There were no signs, whites only, blacks only. But it was like there was an iron curtain there that you just didn't penetrate. But in 1968, a Valpo law graduate named Richard Hatcher, a black man, got elected mayor of Gary. And I'll tell you exactly what happened, because it happened on my block, and it happened on every block in Glen Park. Almost immediately after this guy got elected, for sale signs up, there was this huge flood of people that left to flee to Portage, Valparaiso, Merrillville. People were concerned property values would go down. And there was a great fear that pent-up resentment from black people was going to spill forth in terms of violence against whites. What was 100% white area, I would say it was 75% black. My street turned into just a ghetto. I went down there a couple years ago. It's scary. Any house that isn't boarded up are just a mess. They need paint. There's debris in the yard. You might see a car in a front yard all rusted out. Truthfully, I wouldn't get out of my car in my block now. It just looks rough, like something could happen. But in 1968, we moved to Miller Beach. Lily White, Miller Beach. My street now, where I used to live there in Miller, it's 90% black. However, That house in Miller Beach looks better now than when we lived in it. So it isn't necessarily true that if black people move in, they will destroy. Didn't happen in our Miller neighborhood. Why it happened in Glen Park, I don't know. I'm guilty of not taking a very active role in change, but listen to the way this situation was handled in Gary, Northwest Indiana. Everything would have been fine in Gary if people would have just calmed down. He got elected and it was like, we don't want to talk, we just want to run. As you get older, then you have the luxury to go back and reflect on, why didn't I get active in civil rights in Gary, Indiana? I mean, I didn't even think or care about the Vietnam War. I didn't care about black people. I didn't care about anybody except my own survival, because that's a way I had to think about it. And so, you know, you have regrets about that because you have very strong feelings about these things now. But when you're going through things the way I went through them, you just have to bury it. You have to keep on going.
You can find this story and more regional stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Competitive online gaming, or esports as it's called, has exploded in popularity, especially for college students. The National Association of Collegiate Esports launched in 2016, and it's already has 63 member colleges or universities. One Indiana-based university is trying to turn that popularity into a recruiting tool. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Sophia Salaby takes us to a high school gaming tournament that is hosted by Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, or IUPUI.
When Noel Pumphrey came to IUPUI as a freshman in 2014, there weren't that many options for a student like him interested in playing competitive video games or esports. But during his sophomore year, he decided to give himself and other students more opportunities to connect and play. He started a new club for a variety of competitive games.
Well, I wanted to create something more welcoming for a bunch of different games.
The club now hosts about 100 people a week to play tabletop and video games like League of Legends, which is an online team-based battle game. In spring of 2016, conversations turned to finding new ways to bring more students, both to IUPUI and to the club.
We decided the best way for our club to grow is as a high school recruitment tool. So the deans, four different deans and the Sports Innovation Institute all pitched in $2,000.
That money, $10,000 in scholarships, would be the prize for a high school League of Legends tournament that the university would host. The winning team would be able to split the money among members, $2,000 for each player during their first semester at IUPUI. When Pumphrey put out the call for teams, he was thinking the tournament would mostly draw from Indiana and other Midwestern schools.
Really expected kind of more from like Ohio and Michigan and Kentucky. There was Indiana and Illinois, but there weren't any other bordering states.
In all, 27 teams from 5 states signed up to compete.
So it was about a 13-hour drive, yeah. It was a lot of effort coordinating.
Kyle Notstein and his team came from Gainesville, Florida, to compete in the semifinals in Indianapolis this past weekend. Their team didn't win, but he says he enjoyed connecting with other high school and college players.
I think, at the very least, it's a really good opportunity to meet new people. You get to meet different college students. People that work for the school get to interact with the organization. And so I think that's a really good experience for high school students.
Daniel Hancock's team, the Noblesville Millers, placed third in the competition. His team has their own program at their high school with paid staff and other resources.
We'll practice 2 times a week for 3 hours. And then on Fridays, we have every single, all the games from the different esports, they'll all have a workout session on Friday.
Hancock says being able to compete in tournaments like this brings more legitimacy to treating esports just as seriously as basketball or football.
When you have these colleges taking it seriously, that's when parents can take it seriously.
Pumphrey says the tournament is just the beginning. A report from NewZoo, an esports market intelligence firm, projects the esports economy will grow to an industry worth $905 million this year. Pumphrey says that's good news for the state because Indianapolis already has the infrastructure to host big sporting events.
Indianapolis is a big sports hub. We have like the Indy 500. We've had the Super Bowl here. The Banker's Life is huge. So why can't Indianapolis also be an esports hub?
And Pumphrey says he's excited to get prospective students involved in events that will make them both invested in gaming and the university.
So when a high schooler has any kind of passion in video gaming or esports at all, this is a motivator for them to succeed in college.
A team from Illinois took first place, and planning is already underway for next year's tournament. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Sophia Salaby.
The Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana have offered up two more Innovators of the Month awards for the month, and one of them is going to our next guest here on Regionally Speaking. Dr. Teresa Eyman has been the superintendent of the Crown Point Community Schools for now 13 years now. Hard to believe that she's been in the community and doing a lot of things to help improve the educational process for young people in Crown Point and vicinity. And she's with us to talk about it. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. I feel like this is lucky 13 for us. This means that all the children in my school corporation have been with me as their only superintendent. So I'm very honored to speak with you today.
Well, let's go back 13 years. What was the Crown Point Community School Corporation like when you took over as superintendent?
Well, I was recruited to consider Crown Point Schools. I was not interested in Northern Indiana because I thought you had blizzards up here all the time. But I was recruited as a change agent, an innovator, someone who could move this corporation and our student achievement to higher levels. And that's what we did because we lacked at that point focus. And I thought it was a pearl to polish, a wonderful opportunity for a forward-thinking superintendent like myself. And that's exactly what we've done over time. We've improved. And we've always been a good corporation, so that's why I like Jim Collins' work as a foundation. He's a writer about business research of the best American companies. And I came across an airport once, his first book, which is a first book on the research, Good to Great.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it was a compilation of the best American companies' research on how they became that top-tier performers. And then later on, he came out with Great by Choice, which he studied the corporations who maintained that high level over time, which is where we're at now. We're maintaining. We follow the good to great research principles, business principles, and now we're with the Great by Choice principles, which is maintaining that high level of performance for our students. And we're a destination site now, you probably know, for families moving in throughout the state,
right,
and Illinois area. Our housing starts are climbing, enrollment's climbing. And we have, interesting enough, we have closed enrollment here. We only accept families who move into our community. So they come and they be a part. That's part of the best practice research, by the way. They become part of the community and involved in our community. It's a wonderful community. We take in a portion of Cedar Lake, all of Crown Point, and all of Winfield.
And you mentioned about the fact that you basically take in new students based on the people that come into the community. And do you find that it's been easier over the last few years, at least, and maybe the entire 13, as the school corporation hasn't made the improvements, to be able to show people that, hey, this is a great school corporation to bring your children to and to educate them and send them on to maybe college or to trade school or whatever they want to do later?
We brag about our students, and we have multiple data points now. I remember asking my principals 13 years ago what we could put on a public relations document about our successes. They were puzzled by that question at that time and were able to come up with a half a page. Now, today, it's easy for them to brag about our students because we are statistical analysis people. We are driven by data, which is what best companies do.
Mm-hmm.
So we have four-page brochure now of all of our data-driven improvements, and that's on our website as well. So it's something to brag about for our community and our family and our business community, too, because we're obviously the economic engine for this area, and we have 1,600 employees. We have healthy salaries.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really the economic engine of this entire area. We're very proud of that because our students go on. We now have a record-breaking 98% graduation rate, which is almost perfect, which is where we're headed. That's our goal always.
Well, in fact, you even started out, you were close, but not quite there. You had started out at 86%, I guess, when you
That's
took
right.
over the corporation. So you've seen the steady improvement over the years, and I know that it is something that takes a while. It doesn't happen overnight.
Oh, no, absolutely not. It's two steps forward, one step back.
Yeah.
We have specific action plans every year. We have SMART goals Everyone is accountable to continuous improvement. We really buy into the research of logistics and analytics, principles of best business practices. And you can see the results, because when you look back, you think, oh my goodness, look at what we've been able to do for our families. When it seemed like insurmountable goals that we wanted to be competitive worldwide, which we are now. We're very competitive worldwide. We actually sought out Advanced Ed Worldwide Accreditation, which has education standards for a student who would like to live in Japan as well as the United States of America.
We're talking with Dr. Teresa Eyman, who's the superintendent of the Crown Point Community Schools, which, by the way, has picked up one of the latest Innovators of the Month awards from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana. And Dr. Eyman, you were mentioning here, and you mentioned at the start of our conversation, and the information from the Society of Innovators also bears this out, too, about the Good to Great book that you came across from Jim Collins that kind of gave you an idea of when you came into the school corporation, how you can make the improvements and the like. And it notes then, too, about the fact that it was a kind of an interesting catalyst to be able to come up with ways to offer better accountability and a performance discipline as well, too. And did you find that through that book and the other accompanying books that you've been able to take advantage of from Mr. Collins, that businesses are not all that different from school corporations?
School corporations are big business, and that's part of the innovative thought patterns we have here. And that is an accepted statement from all of our leaders. They understand that we provide a service to our community, and they actually pay for that service a lot. So yes, we have a culture of discipline here, an ethic of innovation. I like to say many times we get the right people on the bus and ask the wrong people to exit for our employees. So we definitely have a blend of all of us here, core values that are non-negotiable, but the strategies we deploy for continuous improvement are subject to proving merit.
I know that 7 years ago that you had the opportunity as the superintendent of the Crown Point Community Schools to come before residents, voters, patrons in the school district, ask for some financial assistance. You got it back then 7 years ago, and now you're up for renewal this time. What are you asking the voters here in the spring 2018 primary election, because that's when this referendum is going to be up before it's considered, what the voters are going to be asked to do again, once again, I guess, from what was done back in the 7 years ago?
Yes, the financial foundation of a school corporation allows us to accomplish our mission. So that is an ongoing action plan as well. And being a chief financial officer myself in my past life, I can speak the language and understand the data and love mathematics. So when the recession hit, when the state took away property taxes from our teacher fund, when the legislature to address the recession reduced funding for public schools $300 million, and that's over each year for several years now. The warning signs were clear. And actually, we have what I call a war room for kids, which is a strategy room. You've probably seen that in the journal, where we have data charts. And one of those is a financial data chart where what was happening. So we began to do what we do with all of our goals, is have an action plan. And at that time, it took us 2 years because we had 1 year of research of what it meant. Because referenda are new to Indiana. They're common in some other states, but not Indiana. So we had a huge education challenge to educate our folks on what is this about. First of all, what is a referendum, and then what's the financial piece? What happened? And so educating our folks that in Indiana, each state, first of all, has their own way of funding public schools.
Right.
It's in state constitutions, not the national. So Indiana has a history of funding its high-achieving districts the lowest. So we had no room to cut when those cuts came, because we were already funded the lowest. Even our students, which is just some of the oddities in the funding formula. Even our students who come from poverty, and that's one out of every four or five children, folks don't realize we have 20 to 24% poverty. They were funded less than anywhere else. If that child came from another corporation with higher poverty, they would receive a lot more money for that student. We didn't, even for the student needs of that level of poverty. So we had a huge education piece. First of all, I educated myself for a year as the leader, and then for a year with having over 400 individual meetings. It was quite a education piece, but our right. community, once they understood, they were supportive and behind us. But it was not something I enjoyed because I'm not one to panhandle or any of that. And I knew it was a hard, difficult concept. But our community is a wonderful community, and once they were informed, they supported us. Yeah. So what happens now is. The law says that the referendum is for 7 years, and I see why. I really didn't want to go through this again, but I see why. Because you have to go back to your community, and they have a right to know, did you fulfill your promises to us?
Now, you really have to kind of sell them again, in some cases. on the idea of what you did the first time 7 years ago, and convince them that it is going to be worth doing for another 7 years.
Yes, that we fulfilled our promises, and we told them what we didn't want to cut because of financial constraints of Indiana. We will put in this fund referendum, which we did, and it's audited, and it's all a public record, et cetera. But we said we don't want to cut any of our teachers, reduce teachers for financial reasons. So we have over 70 professional educators in that separate fund with all their benefits. That's obviously the number one cost, and the number one, and it should be. Number two, and we did professional surveys, too, to see what our people valued. Thank goodness they valued our teachers number one. So those teachers are there. So that's number one. Number two, they valued our extracurricular activities. You know, all the spell bowl, the Vex robotics, the choir, band, and orchestra after school programs. You know, all those extracurricular activities, which are over 400 to 500 extracurricular activities, because it's been a priority for us. Because those extracurricular activities are directly correlated by research to higher GPAs, grades. As you can imagine, students being involved with significant role models pursuing interests after school hours. So we didn't want to cut those, and all the teachers get for doing that is a little stipend, like $500, $1,500, for all that time they spend. So those are so valuable, and we create those clubs for kids. So those 500 extracurricular activities are in there. 70, more than 70 teachers. And then the third thing that's really important to our people, it's just not required by law, is we have nurses in all of our schools, highly qualified nurses, and that was really important for our families. When the recession came and the state cuts came, a lot of school corporations cut the extracurricular activities. They cut any extra nurses. They didn't have anything extra they cut. They cut teachers. We said we don't want to cut those three things that's so important to you, and that's what they funded, and that's what's in there today. And that's what we're asking them to retain, keep our schools great.
If they approve the request for the renewal of the referendum, that yes. there will be no increase in taxes.
Right. It's the same 21 cents they approved 7 years ago, and it's for another seven. So they'll have another opportunity to revisit in 7 years. Yes, 21 cents, no change.
If you will, give us an idea here on the timetable. We know that we're coming up here, I guess, for the actual question that will be on the ballot in May, on May 8th, the primary election day. What happens after that if things go well and you do get the renewal?
Well, we'll continue. We haven't cut the 70 teachers in there. We'll stay with all their benefits. All the extracurriculars will stay, and we'll continue to increase those because they're so valuable and less expensive. And we'll maintain our nurses. So what you see today with all the results we have, with what they've given us, been so generous and kind to give us, will continue on. We will continue to construct rather than decompress.
Yeah. I noticed, too, that there have been more and more school superintendents, not only here in Northwest Indiana, but in some other places in the state, that have taken a close look at the successful referenda and saying that, well, these folks did something right. They were able to follow the procedures they wanted to proceed and encourage their patrons to support them. And in turn, we've had more successful referenda. In fact, it's even surprised some of the people that keep track of this data that it's gone so well. Do you sometimes get asked by other superintendents, not only here in the region, but elsewhere, well, what did you folks do that you did right that you seem to have had so much success in?
Absolutely, because we were the first in the region and among the first statewide, but certainly in the region, the seven counties, contiguous counties. So that's why the education piece was so lengthy and time intense. So, yes, we were asked after that, how did we do it? And we've shared those practices. You know, we went to the people. You know, we went to our people. That was 400 meetings that we held. With individuals and small groups and large groups, we went to the people with honesty, which is, here's where we're at and what do we value in our community. Well, they value their schools, they value their children's education, and we shared those strategies. So in our brochures, every, you know, the things that you need to do to inform people and then be a listening soundboard for them as well as to what they value in our community.
Dr. Teresa Eiman, thank you for spending time with us today to talk not only about the school corporation that has picked up the Innovator of the Month Award for the success over the last 13 years, but also the success for this referenda that's done so well for the school corporation to keep things going and improve things over the last now 7 years. We appreciate you spending some time with us to talk about it today.
Thank you. Keep our schools great.
Crown Point School Superintendent Teresa Eiman. You know, whether you're captivated by rustic log cabins, or if you love Victorian-era houses, or if you're mad for mid-century modern, well, you'll want to check out this year's Logs de Lustrans Tour. It's going to be held, of course, at the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore here in northwest Indiana. You'll certainly find something that will interest you, and in particular, you want to attend an event that happens the evening before the tour itself. And to find out all about it, let's check in with Todd Zeiger. He's the director of the Northern Regional Office of Indiana Landmarks. Todd, welcome to the show.
Hey, greetings, everyone. Thanks for the opportunity to chat.
Well, first, give us a little history background here about the tour itself and why the tour seems to be so popular when it comes up every May.
This is a great opportunity for folks to explore their nearby national park. The fascinating part about this tour is that within one day or as part of the talk the night before, you can experience over 100 years of architecture pretty much in order, 1850 to past the 1950s. So it's just an amazing opportunity right nearby where, you know, folks live to experience that very wide range from a log structure such as the Irene and Nelson House to something more mid-century like a Lustron or the Meyer House. And we're just really excited. Indiana Landmarks and the National Park and the Dunes National Park Association are partnering up to do this tour, and we're just really, really excited for about a month from now to welcome everybody over.
Now, the tour is going to actually be on May 5th, and that's the day that you want to make note of that you get a chance to check out these great structures. But the evening before, at 7 o'clock on May 4th, there's going to be a very special illustrated talk. The title of the talk is Logs, Glass, and Metal, A Century of Architectural Legacy. Tell us who's involved with that talk, where it's going to be, and why it certainly is very key to how the tour goes.
The topic, the title really lays it out. It just helps folks get this broad range overview of what is within the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, certainly known for its natural environment and wonderful areas and walking in the paths. There's this legacy of logs and glass and all kinds of architecture. So this talk is meant to illustrate that for folks and be able to get that in an hour and a half time frame. Myself, I'll give part of the presentation about it. Cliff Goins with the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore will be involved. Then also, we're adding this year, and each year moving forward, one of the folks that have done work to restore one of the homes as part of the leasing program. And so this year, it's the Schmansky family who have been our partners in restoring the Irene and Oscar Nelson House on US 12. It's that little yellow cottage that if you've driven down 12, you might have noticed. It's part of our leasing program. So they're going to be part of the talk this year to tell their story about restoring the house and what they found and the challenges of restoring a log and later structures. So that's really exciting. This talk on Friday night, the night before May 4th, on May 4th, is at the Portage Park Pavilion right on the lakeshore. And talk about glass and steel, fantastic venue for this.
Now, do you have to have reservations or tickets or something like that to attend the talk?
Yes, we really do ask for that. The talk is limited in number, as are the tickets for the tour themselves. So, and that is pretty easy to find. If folks want to go to our webpage, indianalandmarks.org, and navigate over to the calendar section, you can find the reservation for both the lecture on Friday night and the tour on Saturday, which there are lots of different time slots you can take the tour on.
We're talking with Todd Zeiger, who is Northern Regional Director of Indiana Landmarks, about the special talk on May 4th, learning about the legacy of architecture in Northwest Indiana, in particular, the talk that leads up to the May 5th Logs to Lustrons tour that is happening in the region, how the architecture varies from the 19th century into the 20th century. Tell us about what the Swedish influence is on the region and the landmarks that they have left behind, and then get us into the 20th century and tell us more about the Lustrons.
The fascinating part about the Swedish heritage, you can see it very much so in these log structures, with how they were assembled and put together, the types of corners they would build, and those nuances of those log structures are fascinating. And so when you get inside these houses as part of the tour, some of the walls are exposed. You can actually see these log structures and understand how they were built through the Swedish environment. And it's just a really fascinating look at how buildings were constructed in the mid-19th century. And then as you go through this tour, and also we'll kind of demonstrate through photographs in some limited fashion of the talk as well, as we move into the turn of the century, you can see how houses were added onto, and so the structure changes and the exteriors change. So you'll see that as you visit the Field Station Cooperative site, or perhaps maybe one of the other properties owned by the park that's opened as part of this. So you can kind of see how houses change as you're going through this tour in kind of order. And as you move into the 1950s, one of my favorite interesting children is the Lustron houses, these all-metal homes brought to the site on the truck in 3,000 pieces and assembled like a big erector set. And just a fascinating comparison if you think about starting the day in a log structure and going through and then going through these all-metal structures and be able to compare the differences in those two. And then the Meyer House, which is certainly more, I guess, a modern style, lots of glass and open. Be able to see how that changed. Really, within 100 years, how different these houses looked from solid log structures with smaller windows to a Meyer house with this almost all glass. It's just a fascinating opportunity within an hour, hour and a half tour to be able to live through that century and a half of architecture. Mm-hmm.
I noticed you mentioned this year that you're going to have an opportunity to put the Goodfellow Lodge up for display, which is, I guess, is a new feature within the Logs to Lustrons tour. Tell us about the lodge and how it ties together with the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore Park itself.
Those folks who live nearby are probably familiar with the old lodge and sits there at the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. And it's not been open for public tour in the past, and so we're just excited to offer this opportunity to see inside what you would maybe call a traditional summer camp experience building. Like, very, if you just think about what you would think a lodge looks like and you go inside, it very much is. Lots of wood and a little balcony and, you know, large open space for folks that, the kids that used to go there as a part of the U.S. Steel summer camp. There. And so we're just excited to open this up. We think people are going to be very interested to see inside this building. It's owned by the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, and it doesn't currently have a use. And we think it's a great opportunity for folks to see inside of the building that they've not been able to see before, and offering that for the first time. And that's part of what we're excited about this year, adding that building in.
We talked, too, of course, about the Lustrons and that type of construction of houses back in the 20th century. I lived, in fact, the very first house I actually owned was a National Homes Corporation construction house. And although you wouldn't think that it would have metal walls inside the house, it did. Because I used to have to take a drill to be able to put up a picture. Instead of using a hammer and nail or some type of fastener, I'd have to actually drill a hole and put a screw in to be able to hang a photograph or a painting or something like that, because that was what they used at that time in constructing those prefab houses back then. So it's interesting to hear about these Lustran homes and find that the concept is certainly not dead, to be sure.
The fascinating thing about the Lustran houses, of course, they all the metal walls, and so you would use magnets to hang up your pictures and whatnot during the time frame. It's a fascinating building system, and National Homes and others, the kit houses of the time, trying to meet that post-World War II housing. The folks being able to take a look on the inside of those is a really kind of fun opportunity for sure.
Yeah. And we talk here about wanting to take advantage of the Logs to Lustrans tour, once again this year, offered by the Indiana Landmarks. If you will, Todd, fill us in on the details on how you can get the tickets to be able to attend the tour, and what youngsters will have a chance to do, too, if they happen to come along as a family event.
We will be driving through the Century of Progress District, and we'll talk about that and give some people some overview where those homes are not open. That's a separate tour, which this year is going to be held September 29th. So if folks want to mark their calendar for that, it's moving up this year. So we'll talk about the COP houses, but aren't going in any of those as part of the Logs to Lustrans tour. That's a separate tour. To get tickets for this and the lecture as well as the tour, navigate to the calendar section of our webpage, which is indianalandmarks.org, and you can find both the tickets to reserve for the talk as well as pick a time frame. There's different slots you can pick to take the tour on Saturday, so it fits within your schedule. Tour start in the morning at 8:30, and they go through 2 o'clock. And it's really an opportunity. It's kind of like an open house. You can take a shuttle. You have to take the shuttle, and you can go to these different sites and make your way through. So indianalandmarks.org, and just go to the calendar section and look for Logs to Lustrans. Tickets are limited for both the talk and the tour, so if you're interested, I would just encourage you to get online sooner than later. We sold out last year and expect a similar situation this year.
So. Well, certainly. You want to check that out if you haven't done so before. It's certainly worth the time to make the trek up to the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore from wherever you happen to be to check out not only the May 4th Logs, Glass, and Metal of Century of Architectural Legacy talk that happens the evening before, and then, of course, on May 5th is the actual tour itself, leaving from locations, and you'll find out more about that when you check out the Indiana Landmarks website, too. Todd Zeiger is the Northern Indiana Regional Director of Indiana Landmarks. His office is based over in South Bend, and we appreciate you taking time to talk with us today, Todd, about the upcoming tour, and hope, once again, that it's a sold-out tour, so get your tickets now for either the talk or the tour itself. It's worth the trek up that way, and thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you for the time. I really appreciate it.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us today. Hope you'll join us tomorrow. We'll bring you both conversations about the proposed solid waste materials resource facility that is proposed in the city of Gary.